I would like to stick to my topic, which is the halachic, religious meaning of the existence of the State of Israel. Well, usually when we speak about the reasons why we celebrate Yom HaTzmaut and what are the halachic excuses or reasons for saying Hallel and for being happy, we use terminology that compares the establishing of the State of Israel in halachic measures to the second holiday that was established by our previous sages, and that's Hanukkah. And there are those who encourage and support that comparison, saying it's the same thing. We established 2,500 years ago, almost 2,500 years ago, a kingdom in the State of Israel, which helped us out against the Greece. And as Chachamim were establishing, saying Hallel, reciting the Hallel, 8 days of Hanukkah, it justifies saying the Hallel in for Yom HaTzmaut, because the same thing occurred again when almost 67, 68 years ago, when Ben-Gurion announced the establishing of the Jewish state, actually he has done the same thing as the Maccabites have done almost 2,500 years ago. There are others that disagree with that comparison. They say Yehuda Maccabi and Matityahu, his father, were observant, were devoting themselves to Torah, which we could not say that the Israelis that established the Jewish state held in the same way or followed the same way. There are others who maintain that in those times when the Jewish state was established by the Maccabites, the vast majority of the Jewish people lived in the land of Israel, what we could not say about the Jews in 1948 that were only a small minority that lived in their borders, within the borders of the land of Israel. And there are others who say that support this way or another way, saying or not saying the Hallel. I'm not going to deal with that topic. Not because it's not important, but I think that this is not the main issue that inspires me when I want to talk about the meaning of the existence of the State of Israel. The halachic meaning of the existence of the State of Israel. There are others, I would summarize briefly what are the three or the four well-known insights that try to explain what is the halachic meaning of the existence of the State of Israel. And I'm not undermining each one of those insights, but I will try to focus on another one, which for me it makes the difference between being a part of Torah Eretz Israel or not. So the first approach to the existence of the State of Israel belongs to those who say this is the way we implement what the Rambam says in the beginning of Ilchot Melachim. Shalosh mitzvot, three commands where the Jewish people commanded when they entered the land of Israel. The first one was lemanot aleihem melech, to appoint upon themselves a king, to establish sovereignty, to establish kingdom. And a king doesn't mean only someone that has a crown on his head and someone that his kids will inherit his kingdom. But to appoint upon yourself a king means to establish a government, to establish a regime that will take responsibility on the existence of the Jewish people. And this could be a kingdom of dynasty, it could be a democratic state, whatever. That doesn't make the difference. What makes the difference is whether you are established upon yourself, you accepted upon yourself a sovereignty of someone among the Jewish people that takes control and responsibility of the Jewish people. So when David Ben-Gurion has established 67 years ago, plus 2 days, since we're on Sunday, and it occurred on Friday. So 67 years ago, when he announced the establishing of the Jewish state, after the British Mandate has left the state, the land of Israel, he actually was fulfilling, was implementing that mitzvah of appointing upon yourself a king. There are others who point out a different aspect of the existence of the state of Israel, and this is the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Israel. Well, Jews have lived in Eretz Israel for almost 2,000 years since the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, but yet they were living there under foreign, strange sovereignties. And according to the Ramban, the essence of Yishuv Eretz Israel is implemented only when there is no other sovereignty on the land of Israel. It doesn't, to settle Eretz Israel doesn't mean only to sit there and to plant and to work there, but it means to have your own sovereignty. And that could be a second meaning of what happened in 1948. There could be a third meaning of what happened in 1948, and that's, I would say, usually the aspect of what Rav Lichtenstein, Zachar Tzadik Levracha, following his father-in-law, Rav Soloveitchik, used to say, that establishing the Jewish state was something, a kind of following the hint that Hashem gave us after the Holocaust. And he actually showed us signs and led us to that place. And these are a part. These are the establishing of the Jewish state is actually following these signs of what Hashem has taught us during the terrible World War II that occurred 3 years before that. But I would like to refer to a total different view on the existing of the state of Israel. I don't know who was here in Bnei Akiva, but when I was there as a young guy, there wasn't a group of kids that was not dealing with the following story. And that's a dilemma, a moral dilemma that is raised by the Gemara in Masechet Baba Metzia. Two people, two human beings, are going in the desert, and they have only one bottle of water. And the options are as the following. If one of them will drink the water, he will survive. But then his friend will die in front of him. The second option is that both of them will drink the water, but then none of them will survive. How should the person behave? How should a moral man behave in such a case? By the way, Rav Lichtenstein, when secular officers used to come to Yeshivat Har Etzion, and we had a dilemma, what will be the Gemara that we should learn with them? That was one of the Gemaras that he always recommended, to learn this Gemara in order to confront ourselves and to confront them with the moral dilemma that is discussed, that is debated in the Gemara. So, the Gemara offers two ways, two positions regarding that dilemma. One is one was held by Ben Petora. It's not a very famous Tana, but it was, as the Gemara says, actually his way of thinking was accepted for many years. And Ben Petora said the following: Mutar yishtu shnehem. They would be better off if both of them will drink. Ve'al yir'eh ha'echad b'mot chavero. I don't want to see how his friend is dying in front of him. Which seems to be not too rational position, but more an emotional approach to that situation. How could you live after you've seen your friend dying in front of you? So you'd be better off. Mutav yishtu shnehem. It's better that both of them will drink, rather than one will drink and the other one will die in front of his eyes. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva. That's the terminology that the Gemara uses. עד שבא רבי עקיבא and taught us וחי אחיך עמך, חייך קודמים לחייך. Your life is prior to the life of your friend. That's what Rabbi Akiva said. Ad Sheba Rabbi Akiva sounds to us familiar. We've just read the Haggadah of Pesach. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, "Kol, I was never reading Krishma. I was never zoche sheteamer yetziat Mitzrayim balelot ad Sheba ben Zoma, until someone came and started to darshan that pasuk that allows and actually commands us to say, to recite Yitziat Mitzrayim, to remind Yitziat Mitzrayim at night, not only in Kriyat Shema of the morning. So there were two positions, and we ended up with Rabbi Akiva, and his position was accepted halachically, that if these two the gentlemen walk in the desert, so the one that owns the water is not only a title, but actually is commanded to drink his water and to let his friend to die in front of him. Chayecha kodmim lechayecha. And there is another Gemara that says the following. By the way, that's the Rabbi Akiva that is so famous, that is so well known with his very, very important rule. Rabbi Akiva omer klal gadol b'Torah ve'avta l'ra'acha kamocha. But yet, ve'avta l'ra'acha kamocha. But you are not committed to help your friend when it replaces your life. Your life is prior to the life of your friend. There is another Gemara. Says the form. Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha. That's a pasuk. This week's parsha. By us in Israel, it was last week's parsha, but you will read it this week. Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha. You should not stand aside when you see someone that is dying in front of you. Someone is getting drunk. Someone is under danger, and you stand aside and you don't interfere. You don't try to help. By the way, it was established as a law in the state of Israel 12 or 15 years ago as a civil law, that if someone sees anyone wounded and doesn't go to help him, he could be sued and could sit in jail for several years for not helping someone that is under danger, which is called Chok Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'acha. That's the name of that bill. Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'acha. Now what happens if in order to help my friend I have to put myself in danger. Should I do that? So there is a big debate about that among the poskim, Rishonim and Achoinim. I won't go into the sugya, but the conclusion is, according to most of the poskim, that you don't have to put yourself in danger in order to help somebody else that is in danger. Because Pikuach Nefesh is above everything, and your Pikuach Nefesh is above the Pikuach Nefesh of your friend, which follows the same idea of Chayecha Kodmim Lechayei Chavercha. Your life is prior to the life of your friend. Again, the same idea. By the way, one of the proofs of that position is the following. You remember the very famous verse that is written in Sefer Shmot. Hashem tells Moshe to go back to Egypt to help his brothers and sisters, to redeem them from Egypt. And then he says the following, Shuv Mitzrayma ki metu kol ha'anashim ha'mevakshim et nafshecha. You can go back to Egypt to help your nation, because all those who wanted to kill you are dead already. So there are a few of the Meforshim that raised the question, and suppose they did not die, and Hashem tells you to go to Egypt and to redeem these people? Suppose they did not die. Why does the pasuk emphasizes that they died? So a part of them proved from that verse, from the fact that the Torah emphasizes that these people are dead already, that if they were not dead, Moshe had an excuse to tell Hashem that he doesn't want to go to Egypt, because he doesn't have to put himself in danger in order to save his people. Okay, if that's the story, and I think that most of the rabbis and most of the Mefarshim agree to the way I analyzed, to the way I put it the last couple of minutes, that idea. So then let me ask a question. I guess I don't have to tell you here, I don't have to tell you about one of the Israeli heroes that sacrificed his life a few years ago in the Second Lebanese War, in the Second War in Lebanon, Roy Klein. I don't have to tell you this name, that jumped on the grenade, covered the grenade with his body, screaming Shema Yisrael and saving his soldiers. And it was a rabbi, it was a Talmid Chacham. And how could he do that? Was he allowed to do that? I mean, we use this name and we mention this name with such admiration, with such respect. Generations of kids are raised on that role model of Roy Klein, Hashem Yikom Damo. But maybe was he wrong? Chayecha kodmim lechayecha vecha. Your life is prior to the life of your friend. So how could you sacrifice your life in order to save your friends? But actually, why should I ask it only on Roy Klein? I could actually ask that on every soldier that goes to war. How is he allowed to do that? He is putting himself in danger in order to save other lives. He could escape to Chicago, could escape to elsewhere. Why should he put himself in danger in order to save other lives? By the way, there is Sefer HaChinuch that says that when someone comes to fight with Amalek, or someone wants to fight with the Canaanites, is commanded to do that as long as he is not putting himself in danger. So the Minchat Chinuch asked, how could it be possible? Did you ever see a war that does not require people that put themselves in danger? But yet Sefer HaChinuch said that this is the idea. You know that, I guess, the eldest people here remember, the others maybe know about that from the movies, but in 1976, which is almost 40 years ago, there was a very famous operation called Yonatan Operation, where the Prime Minister's, Netanyahu's brother, sacrificed his life in order to save those who were captured by the German terrorists and were taken to Uganda, to Entebbe. And you know, when the paratroops released those captures, everybody was very happy and was very proud of the state of Israel that has succeeded to release those Israelis and those whoever were captured there. But there was one American rabbi that had the courage to say, against everybody, and when I say everybody, it's everybody, there was one that did not take part in all the festivals that took place after the releasing of those people, and this was the Satmar Rebbe that lived in New York, Yoel Moshe, and he said, this was not permitted to be done, because the Prime Minister took risk, it caused death of four civilians and one officer, Yonatan Netanyahu. He caused them, he's responsible for the bloodshed of those five. He should have released the terrorist that he was asked to do that, to do, and he should not put soldiers, hundreds of soldiers, in danger in order to release them. He shouldn't have done that. And he quoted that Gemara that I've just quoted a few moments ago. Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha. You should never stand aside when someone is in danger, but as long as you don't put yourself in danger. And what he has done was putting them in danger. Not only putting them in danger, but causing the death of five people there. Which was a very, very tough question. Although nobody wanted to hear that. But the comment was very reasonable. Allah, it was reasonable. So why was he wrong? Why is he wrong? In order to answer that, I would like to share with you a story that I guess it's not famous for most of you. It took place 500 years ago near the Greek islands between Turkey and Greece. There was a group of merchants that went for the business, and they were captured by a group of robbers. And the robber, after he robbed all the goods, all the money that they held with them, he wanted to kill them. And then, when he wanted to kill them, there was one woman that was a wife of one of the merchants, and she offered to the head of the robbers, "Look, I have a deal for you. I'll become your wife, and you will save the lives of my husband and his friends." So he agreed to the deal. And she became his wife. A few months or years later, he was found by the police or the army of one of that state. And the husband, with his wife, came over to the rabbi that was in one of those cities. His name was Yosef Kulon Maharik, a very famous rabbi in those times. And they came to him with a question. Since this lady lived with that goy, but because she wanted to save her husband and she wanted to save her husband's friends' lives, is she allowed to go back to live with her husband? Because usually if someone is not loyal to her husband, she's not permitted to come back to live with him. But here, it was exceptional because she was doing this in order to save her husband's life. So the answer was negative. He said, "No, you're not allowed, although you thought that it is permitted to do that in order to save your life, your husband's life, but yet you're not allowed to come back to live with him because it's he interprets a verse that says, "Uma'ala ma'al bi'isha," and this is considered to be Me'ilat Mal, she was not loyal to her husband, so therefore, although she wanted to save her husband, therefore, she's not allowed to live with him together. That was the answer. 250 years later, one of the very famous rabbis in Germany sends a question. His name was Yeshayahu Pick. That's his name, Rabbi Yeshayahu Pick. He sends a question to a very, very famous rabbi that used to live in Prague, and his name was Yechezkel Landau, the Noda Biuda. And he sends to him a question, "I don't understand the answer of that Maharik. I couldn't understand. Why can't I understand that?" And he says the following: "We all celebrated Purim a few months ago, 2 months ago. And what was the story of Purim? Mordechai, a Yehudi, sends his wife," actually, because according to Chazal, Esther was married to Mordechai. He sends his wife to Ahasuerus. Now, Ahasuerus is not going to learn with Esther b'chavrusa. Once she will come willingly, once she will initiate to save the Jewish people and to cancel the command of Haman to kill all Jews, he would want his prize, and his prize will be to be with Esther Amalka. So how could Mordechai do that, sending his wife to Ahasuerus? And actually, what's the difference between Esther Amalka and that poor lady that wanted to save her husband's life? So that was the question that Rabbi Yeshayahu Pick sent to the Noda Biuda. And then Rebbe Yehuda gives several answers. The most important answer is what is relevant to us today. By the way, Rabbi, you didn't tell me when I have to stop, and I don't know how do I hold with the time. I could continue so far. Okay. So then Rebbe Yehuda answers in the following answer, and he says, Esther Amalka is different. Why is she different? Because it was for the sake of Klal Yisrael. Because it was in order to save all, the entire Jewish nation. And in that case of the Maharik, it was in order to save some individuals. What's the difference between saving Klal Yisrael and saving individuals? Rav Kook explains this in a very, very famous tshuva that he wrote almost 90 years ago. And he said the following. We know, usually, that there is one Torah. One Torah was given to Moshe in Har Sinai. Torah Shebechtav, Torah Shebaalpeh. If it's so, how come the king is commanded to write two Sifrei Torah? I guess all of us would have been pleased if the prime minister would have observed one Sefer Torah. Why does he have to write two Sifrei Torah? So Rav Kook explains, because there are two types of Torah. There is the Torah for the individuals, and there is the Torah for the tzibur, for the public, for the nation. And although the words that are written in both books are the same, but the way you implement those rules are completely different. And let me give you an example. When the Jewish state was established, we had a dream, maybe an illusion, that we'll be able to implement the halacha in the state of Israel in all areas that are possible. So one of the rabbis was asked the following question. Now listen to the question. Suppose someone stole your car in the middle of Shabbos. It's not pikuach nefesh. I mean, there are people that the money is, they love the money more than they love their body, but yet, most of the people, and especially when we have insurance, I mean, so someone stole the car, I mean, it's not the end of the world. Is he allowed to call the police to tell them that the thief has just stolen the car 5 minutes ago? He called. He didn't know what the halacha says, if he's allowed or he's not allowed. He called. And the policeman picked up the phone and he hears that someone was stealing the car. Is he allowed to chase after that robber, after that ganev, with a car? It's not a pikuach nefesh. He just stole a car. So that rabbi suggested that he should chase the robber with a bicycle. So the second rabbi says to him, are you kidding? Are you kidding? Suppose the He will drive a Buick or a Cadillac car, and the police will chase after him with a bicycle. Are you serious? And so he says to him, no, I understand that it sounds funny, but how could you explain a different answer? How could you justify a different answer? So he says to him, according to you, suppose Ben-Gurion would have come to the chief rabbi and would have asked him, I give you the responsibility for the security in the state of Israel. The interior security and the external security. Now, how do you deal with these problems of internal security? How would you deal with that rubber, with that gun? So what would I tell him? I would chase after that thief with bicycle. Suppose the Torah would be led by rabbis, by the Shulchan Aruch. So Shabbos will become paradise for thieves, for rabbis, for rabbis? Is that possible? So the rabbi said, you sound reasonable, you sound rational, but where is it written? Where is it written that when you deal with a country, when you deal with a state, the rules are different? So that rabbi pointed him out to the tshuva of Rav Kook, and he said, that's exactly what is written there. That there is one way that you translate Torah to individuals, and there is a different way that you implement Torah to a nation. Because it's impossible that a nation will run in such a way, will be led, will be conducted in such a way that it's possible to thieve, it's possible to steal, it's possible to rob, because it's not pikuach nefesh. There are issues that when you apply to individuals, there are financial issues. But when you deal with a nation, these issues become a pikuach nefesh issues. For instance, and Rav Kook continues in this very famous answer. And he says, usually we know that pikuach nefesh is above everything, except of three things: worshipping idols, bloodshed, and adultery. Okay. But when it comes to a nation, it doesn't work this way. When the king wants to go to a war, he doesn't go to a war because of worshipping idols. He doesn't go to a war because of adultery. He doesn't go to the war because of bloodshed. He's going to cause bloodshed. How come a king is allowed to go to open a war? How come he will be able to have a war against the Canaanites or against the Amalek? It's a part of the 613 mitzvot, but yet pikuach nefesh is above that. So Rav Kook says, no, it's above all commands when it applies to the individuals. But when it comes to the kingdom, the king is allowed to open a war, to begin a war, not only for those reasons. The Gemara describes how David HaMelech made wars. We don't have to come to David HaMelech. We can see how the American presidents began wars. Usually not because of pikuach nefesh. They started it because of democracy, because of price of oil, because of prices of other things. And David HaMelech, that's the way the Gemara describes. There was an economic crisis in David's kingdom. So his advisors came over to it. That's the beginning of the Gemara in Masechet Brachos. They came over to him and said, well, we have a problem. So he said, what's the problem? Please make business one with another. So they say to him, En habor mitmale michulyato, ve'en hakometz masbi'a et ha'ari. Look, we could not fill the bowl, the hole, with the sand that we've just taken out from him. We need something external. So then he said to them, so what's the problem? Tse'u upishtu begdud, which the precise translation, or at least the practical translation of that, go and do some wars. And once you make a war, the economy will develop. So what's the reason for that war? Not because of Yeshua Eretz Israel, not because of other ideological reasons, but in order to improve the economy. And people will die in that war. How could he do that? The reason is, Rav Kook explains, because that's a second Sefer Torah. There is one Sefer Torah of the individuals, there is a second Sefer Torah of the public, of the nation. Let me give you another answer. Unfortunately, I guess if someone is sick, someone has his son or his mother, his wife are sick, and he needs to sell properties in order to make an expensive surgery, he will do that. As the Pasuk says, Kol hon yiten adam be'ad beito. Someone needs. And that's the idea of pikuach nefesh, that someone will spend all of his money, all of his goods, in order to save his life, in order to save his family's life. That's rational, and that's halachic as well. Now, I could tell you for sure that in Israel, every year, there are thousands of people that die, and their lives could have been lengthened in 2 or 3 or 5 years, if the government would have put to the health budget another $1 billion, another $2 billion. The medicine basket is added every year with 300 million shekels. I guess if it was added in a billion shekels, I know, it's not a guess, we know it as a fact, that if they would have bought the ELISA machines or other subsidizing other medicines, more and more people could live for more years. Now suppose the prime minister again, the same prime minister that came to the rabbi with the police, would have arrived to the rabbi and would have asked, look, I have 5 billion shekels. Now I could do with these 5 billion shekels, which are more than $1 billion, I could do with that one of the two. I could subsidize medicines. I could buy a few dialysis machines and other issues in order to save people's lives. That's one option. But if that's the case, then I will have to cut the Torah subsidizing of the yeshivot. Or I will have to cut, forget yeshivot, I will have to cut the budget of the educational ministry, and to cut the studies, even the hall studies, even the secular studies in the elementary schools. I will have to shorten the day school, not if they today learn 6 hours a day, I could do it, but then I will have to shorten it. Instead of 6 hours a day, they will have to study only 5 hours a day. Could you see a rabbi that will say, yes, you should shorten the length of the studies, and you should give these 5 billion shekels to the medicines? Maybe. I don't believe I will find that rabbi. Why? Although by the individuals, that for sure was the decision. If someone will have to weigh what is the value of saving someone's life, and the alternative is not sending the kid to the best school, or to not sending him to the university that costs a lot of money, and the other option is to save the life of the mother or the father or whoever else that is in a family, I guess the average person will do that. But when it comes to a country, when it comes to the nation, the way you weigh things is different. That's the Torah of the nation. So what occurred in 1948 is not only that we appointed a king, is not only that we are implementing the essence of Mitzvat Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, it's not only that we're following the voice of the Almighty after the Holocaust, it is something which is much more meaningful. We arrived to the second level of Torah. We started to rewrite the second level of Torah, which applies to the Tzibur, which applies to the nation. Now, to understand that, or to give more meaningful meaning to that, I would like to add something that Rav Kook says in one of his very famous paragraphs in the book Orot. And he says something which for people that live in the diaspora might sound a bit strange, and maybe will cause a few of us inconvenient, but yet that's what he's writing. He says the following. The Torah was given to Abraham not because you cannot be a holy man or a woman without the Torah. You could relate to other religions as an individual and yet be a good man. There are holy people among other religions as well. You don't have to be Jewish in order to be holy. As an individual, the purpose and the reason why Hashem has chosen Abraham is in order to create, in order to establish a Jewish nation, not a Jewish religion for individuals, but a Jewish nation for the Jewish people that will teach the world that nations could follow the way of Hashem, the way of justice and law. not only individuals, because individuals could be found everywhere. Good people that are following the way of tzedakah and mishpat. But to show how a nation that has an army and uses these words, and culture, and agriculture, and workers, and economy, and to show that all these areas that are run by the public could be run by people that follow the way of Hashem, this is the purpose of Klal Yisrael. Everything that we are doing during those 2,000 years that we lived in the diaspora is only a preparation for the second level of Torah that we were privileged to start to write 67 years ago, to start to rewrite the Sefer Torah of the nation. That Sefer Torah that will teach us how should we deal dilemmas of army in a war, killing civilians, not killing civilians, what are the priorities, in order to teach us how we should run economy, what should be the differences between the rich and the poor people, what will be the involvement of the government in order to bridge social gaps between societies, if at all. How should culture behave? How should artists behave in a Jewish country? What are the borders of freedom, freedom of speech and freedom of art, etc., etc.? All these ideas are the public, the national park, the people's park, part of Torah. There's a very unique Gemara that usually is not mentioned. But the Gemara says the following. The Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah says that when Hashem redeemed Klal Yisrael from Egypt, and He said to them, I want to give you Torah, they said to Him, well, fine, it's fine with us, but we have one condition. So I asked them, what is the condition? So they said to Him, Al menat she'en uma velashon sholetet ban, which means, we are ready to receive Torah, but in order to be able to implement the Torah, we need to have our own sovereignty without being dependent on nobody else's, without being slaves of any other regime. In order to fulfill that part of Torah, we have to be independent. We have to have our own sovereignty. And that brings me to, I'm saying it as an anecdote. You know, there is a very famous halakha that says the following. 30 days before Pesach, you should start to learn the Ilchot Pesach. We understand what's the importance of that, because there are so many halachot in Pesach, you have to learn them again and again in order to remember them, in order to recall what is asur and what is mutter, how you should bake the matzah and how you should clean the house from chometz, etc., etc. 30 days before Sukkot, you have to prepare yourself for Sukkot. Again, so many halachot of Sukkah and the four minim, etc., etc. 30 days before Shavuos, you have to prepare yourself for Shavuos. I mean, what is there to be learned 30 days before Shavuos? How to bake cheesecakes? I mean, what is there to be learned 30 days before Shavuos? What do you have to learn? What do you have to prepare yourself? If you give a look in the Baher Eitev, I don't remember if it's in the Siman Taf Kaftet in the beginning of Ilchot Pesach, or if it is in Taf Tzadik Daled in Ilchot Shavuot. This I could not recall, because the last time I saw that was, I think, 30 years ago. But the Bahetiv says the following. Behei Be'iyar Matchilim Lilmod Ilchot Shavuot. Hei Be'iyar is the Independence Day. Hei Be'iyar, 30 days before Shavuot, you start to learn, you start to prepare yourself to Matan Torah. So, I don't really know how many halachot you have to learn before Shavuos in order to prepare yourself. But I have another interpretation for that preparation. The preparation of Matan Torah begins with the understanding of the meaning of Hei Be'iyar. Once people understand that the real preparation of Matan Torah is to understand the Torah was given to us Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim v'natan lanu et torto. Torah was given to us not as individuals. Torah was given to us as a nation. Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim. Torah was given to Moshe when he came with 600,000 people. Mamash, as David Ben-Gurion has established the existence of the state of Israel, the independence of the state of Israel, when we were 600,000 people in 1948. Avraham Avinu did not receive the Torah. He was following the ways of Torah by himself, but he never received Torah. And the Maharal explains, because Torah was given to a nation. It was not given to individuals. And the real preparation for Kabbalah Torah is the understanding that the most important way to implement Torah is by a nation. We all have to practice our mitzvot, and we are committed to follow and to observe our mitzvot as individuals because we are Jewish. But it all only a kind of a preparation to the higher level of Torah, to the main purpose of Torah, which is intended to be implemented in a nation, through a country, through a state. So the real meaning of establishing the Jewish state is the rewriting of the Torah of Klal Yisrael. Is to be engaged, re-engaged again and again to the original meaning of Torah, which was given in order to be implemented through a public, through a nation, through a country, and not only through individuals. So for me, when I come to Yom HaAtzmaut, it's the meaning of that day, the halachic meaning of that day, is that we know that we have now the platform for the second level of Torah, which is the main level of Torah, the Torah of the nation. The Torah where weak line is not only allowed to sacrifice life, but that's actually the ideal of Torah when it's written through, when it's implemented through a nation, that in that level of Torah, someone is committed, and every soldier is a shaliach of Klal Yisrael and should be ready to sacrifice life for Klal Yisrael. To be a part of the Hilchot Tzibur, to be a part of the second level, of the second type of Torah, is to understand that when we will deal with the questions, and we have so many questions that we have to confront with once we arrived to that second Sefer Torah, that we should feel blessed that we have the privilege to be a part of the second Sefer Torah that is written in our generation. So I guess I have to leave 2 minutes for questions, and that's it. Thank you very much.
I think we'll hold the questions for another time.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Stav. We're going to take a 2-minute break, and then we have Rabbi Myers will be sharing with us his presentation.